My name is Michael Guyatt, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour is Dan Russo. Dan, been a minute. I know you, but introduce yourself to the audience. Who are you? What's your background? What have you done throughout your career? What are you doing currently?
Hey, Michael, good to see you. Thanks for having me on. Hopefully everyone can hear me okay. So I'm Dan Russo, portfolio manager at Potomac Fund Management, where I've been for coming up on 3 years now. We are a tactical manager using technical analysis systematically, meaning we don't do anything without testing it, to manage 4 funds. Now, just a quick compliance out of the way. I cannot talk about the funds. I will not talk about our funds, and I will not talk about anything that we currently hold inside of our funds. So let's just kind of get that out of the way quickly. Started my career on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, right at the top of the dot-com bubble. Had a front row seat for the bursting of that, the collapse of Enron, and all the things that kind of happened in the 2000 to 2003 timeframe. Before moving to a sales and trading desk where I covered, meaning they were my clients, some of the largest hedge fund managers in the world. If I said their names, you would know them. Before landing in this seat here, I always wanted to be in a money management role. And this is where I sit now for the past 3 years.
Okay. So on this point about, I'm glad you mentioned you start off saying systematically investing and testing things. I often critique what I call the squiggle boys, right? Sort of the people that reference technical patterns without having any clue of whether or not it has predictive power. I was looking at your timeline and it seems like you have a similar sort of disdain for that. Let's talk about the importance of testing a strategy, testing a rules-based systematic approach. And why do you think it's so hard for people to want to actually get proof about what they're saying, if there's any real power to it?
Yeah, because I think the majority of the time they'll find out what they're saying is there's nothing to it, right? It's a lot of kind of folklore passed down over the years, things that might have made sense at a time when you couldn't readily test what was being told to you. And I'll admit that early in my career, I was that way, right? The New York Stock Exchange is full of a lot of kind of old folklore and rules of thumb passed down from trader to trader over decades. And it wasn't until I was deeper into my career that I started to think about things more systematically and testing them. And I think it's just really, it's kind of like the way we think about it is Moneyball, right? For the markets. It's about probabilities, not prediction. Invariably, when somebody understands or learns that you're involved in the market, they ask you, what do you think the market's going to do? And, you know, my stock answer to that is I have no idea, but here's what my models are saying and what that means over time. I just think it's, you know, it's a good way to get a baseline for the investment decisions that you're making and a good way to build a repeatable process, which I think if you are going to be a professional money manager, and I will separate out the term investor. When I say investor, I mean professional money manager. In the context, I don't mean money manager as in trading your own account, where you're probably not going to fire yourself, right? I'm talking about investors who have to manage to a prospectus, manage to a mandate, answer to clients other than themselves. And whenever you're in that situation, having a repeatable process that you can point to is a good way to determine whether what you're doing makes sense or whether your results are maybe not repeatable and largely due to luck.
And a lot of that also has to do with a recognition around what cycles a process does better or worse in, which we'll touch on. But on the testing and models, let's talk about some of the tools that you use. When I first started doing backtesting in 07, 08, I was all over TradeStation, easy language. I was downloading white papers on SSRN, backtesting all kinds of factors. And I found a lot of stuff really had no predictive power back then, just running all kinds of iterations on things. But, you know, there's things like TradeStation, there's Excel, there's R. What are some of the things that you look to validate, you know, a systematic approach?
So we do everything inside of a software called AmyBroker, which has its own coding language. Tyler Lovengood, who I see is on this call, came to us recently as a research associate, largely because he also used AmyBroker. It's not something that's widely used. We mostly use data from Norgate and FastTrack. So anything kind of that we want to test, we can write code for, test it over specific look back periods and see if there's any predictive power to it. We don't do anything without doing that first. And what's kind of interesting about how we look at the world is whenever we say systematic, I think the first thing that people think of is, you know, black box, quantitative, and that's not what we are at all. a lot of the indicators that we use can be traced back to, you know, books like Edwards and McGee and, you know, Fosbach's book, like, you know, Stock Market Logic, et cetera. It's just the implementation and combination of indicators that we use that adds value. I mean, we use a version, not the exact version, but we use our take on Dow theory, right? This is something that's over 100 years old. We have a take on Marty Zweig's bond model. Again, something that's decades old, right? So nothing black box about what we're doing. It's the thoughtful combination of indicators, and the software that we use is really what allows us to do that testing. It's pretty powerful.
If you were to guess, what percentage of available indicators have legitimate predictive power? You know, is it 15%, 10%, less than 1%? Yeah, what's your sense of that?
All right, I think you have to separate out indicators and combinations of indicators. I think most indicators on their own are pretty terrible for the most part, at least in their stock form that we all first learn about them, right? A great example of this is the RSI indicator, right? We all kind of know what the RSI indicator is. It's an oscillator. The default settings are 14 days, oversold at 30, overbought at 70. Well, I would be willing to bet that if you test this and you bought some product every time it became oversold, i.e. crossed below 30, and sold it every time it became overbought, i.e. closed above 70, you would have a really short career as an investment manager if that's all you use. What percentage? I would say probably maybe 20% have predictive value on their own. However, I hate to use the word art, but it is kind of the most apropos term. The art is the combination of indicators, right? And I think that gets back to setting an environment. You know, do you want to buy oversold blindly? Probably not. But if you have some way of defining the environment, i.e. we're in a strong uptrend, and then you want to buy oversold within the context of that uptrend, you're probably going to get different results. So individual indicators, I mean, when you're doing research, it's never about one data point. It's always going to be about building this mosaic and a weight of the evidence approach. Fundamental analysts do it in their own way, right? They start by usually reading up on a company, building out their financial statements, and then start connecting the dots from a research perspective. It's no different for technical analysis. It's this combination of data points or indicators is what adds value. Any one indicator on its own, probably pretty useless.
You used the exact word that was coming to mind when you were speaking, mosaic. I was literally about to interject and say that word. I think that is the right way to frame it. Now, just because you test an approach, just because you back test it, doesn't mean that it's going to work in all environments. And I think this is where there's a lot of confusion. And from my perspective, somebody like you is in business, frustration, because everything has cycles, including factors. Everything has cycles, including indicators. There are times when particular indicators or combination of indicators are just firing all cylinders. There are times when it's not. How much of a repeatable alpha generating process is because of that process, those indicators, or because you happen to be executing that process in the right environment for what you're trying to take advantage of? Because I think this is where it gets into a bigger discussion on active versus passive, the last decade of large cap US only dominance, and it goes really into the name of the space, which is how do you beat the market?
Right. So I think that's a good point. I think that anytime anyone says that they have something that works 100% of the time, you should run fast and run far in the other direction, right? They're about to pick your pocket. They're going to scam you in some way, shape, or form. And nothing works 100% of the time. I mean, listen, there are trend followers, hardcore, like when I say old school CTA type trend followers, where some of those investors are happy to have a 40 to 45% hit rate. I think environment is important, but I think risk management in all environments is the key to long-term success as an investment manager, right? Because you can have a lower hit rate, but if you're making substantially more on the trades where you're right than you're losing on the trades when you're wrong, you could have a long career as a professional money manager. But I do think environment is important. Look, I'm a momentum person. And, you know, all my life, all my career, all I want to do is get to the money management side. All I want to do is manage money. I get to the money management side 3 years ago, and momentum kind of, you just look at an ETF like MTUM, go up until this year, goes into a 2.5 year, right? Does that mean momentum works? Doesn't work, rather? I'm not willing to say that. Things come and go, which is why I think risk management is the most important factor that will allow you to do well through a lot of cycles. and have that longevity. The key is to stick around.
Yeah, Meb Faber of Cambridge has got a number of funds. You know, his line is, you know, survival is the key, right?
Ran into Meb at a conference 2 weeks ago out in Park City, Utah, and we were chatting. And, you know, Meb's work has been a huge influence on how I view markets. I teach the technical analysis class at Baruch College in New York City, and I assigned probably two or three of Meb's papers as assigned reading for the class. And, you know, a lot of his work has influenced my views on the world. So I tend to agree with most of what Meb says.
Okay. So the thing I pulled up the MTUM, and yeah, I mean, it looked like small cap sideways for a whole bunch of last year. And then obviously had that, you know, enormous runoff of the November level. But
yeah, these factors come and go, to your point. Investment styles come and go, which is why, you know, a disciplined risk management process is important. You know, and this is where there's a huge difference between managing money for yourself, right? Who you're probably, like I said, not going to fire. I mean, if you fire yourself, I guess you are really honest with yourself and you're saying, hey, I'm not good at this. Let me hire somebody else. Or as opposed to managing money for other people, right? Because investors are impatient and we all know that investors tend to chase performance. So, you know, if you're running too long with a style that goes out of favor, right? There's career risk to that, which is why risk management, again, I will always come back to risk management, because that's what gets you to Meb's theory of, you know, just survive, longevity.
Let's explore that risk management, because a lot of people use that term risk management, but, you know, let's talk about in execution. Now, I am, me personally, separate from my own strategies, which, you know, as you know, are run to prospectus, right? I view risk management in terms of conditions and probabilities, not in terms of stop losses. Right? I know a lot of technicians like to use stop losses. How do you define risk management on a position basis, but then really on a total portfolio basis? Because I think if you're going to do it on the total portfolio, it does kind of go back to what's the cycle you're in that favors, yeah, the approach.
Agreed. So for risk management, again, we have composite models that we use here at Potomac, and those composite models drive the decision-making process, right? Obviously, there are inputs from myself, now Tyler, who's on board, and our CIO and CEO, Manish Khanna. But once the model is in place, that drives the decisions, right? So the step one for us is the model. What's the model saying? Basically, the model answers the question, do you want to be invested? And then if the answer to that question is yes, you want to be invested, then we have four separate funds that each have their own mandate, right? So risk management starts at the model level, right? Do you want to be invested or do you not want to be invested? Now, the model itself crunches data every day. We run it every day and it answers that question. Do you want to be in the market or do you not want to be in the market? Some individual indicators within the model do have a stop, largely because we understand that tails are fat, right? A great example of that is we have an indicator that references the VIX. And we all know that a lot of the time, the VIX tends to be mean reverting. However, that handful of times when the VIX is not mean reverting, meaning when the VIX kind of gets above 30 and then just keeps going, right? And then all of a sudden you wake up one day and the VIX was at 30 and now it's at 80 and you have this massive gap risk in the market, right? So we try to understand each of the individual indicators that makes up the models, right? So something that utilizes the VIX probably has a stop on it. Not probably, it does have a stop on it. But the model itself, the composite model itself, does not have stops, and we don't have stops on individual positions. Now, two of the strategies that we run are rotation strategies. So the risk management there kind of takes care of itself. If something is strong enough relative to the rest of the investment universe, it gets into the portfolio. If it doesn't maintain its place at the top of the list, it rotates out of the portfolio. So we do not have individual stops and positions. A few of our indicators have stops, but generally speaking, risk management is driven by the model itself.
Now, you said, you know, you used the term the market a few times there, right? And obviously, most people, when you say the market, their mind goes to the S&P 500, even the NASDAQ as well. But the market is really a question of sort of what's your opportunity set, right, that you're playing with, right? If you're going to play the market in terms of small caps and use a set of signals, you're likely in the last, you know, year to have been whipsawed to death, right, with a whole bunch of sideways, at least in the Russell 2K. If you did that on emerging markets for the last decade plus, you know, volatile cash, you know, you're not really going anywhere. And I reference that because I think there's always this question of sort of, does the opportunity set how you're defining the market to have a broader tailwind to reduce whipsaw risk, right? The last decade or so has been great for momentum. If you're doing momentum in large cap US, not so much for a lot of other parts of the marketplace. So how do you think through, from a model perspective, what are the options to play with, right? Because again, you need to have that tailwind. Otherwise, from an active perspective, you're going to get a lot of these type two errors.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So generally speaking, we are using the data that we're using. We use a lot of NYSE data, right? So broader than, say, just the S&P 500. Our biggest fund, however, invests in the S&P 500 predominantly, concentrated positions in the S&P 500. The other funds that kind of have a broader investment universe or opportunity set, to use your term, that's, again, where some of the art comes in, right? What goes into that basket? Now, momentum kind of handles that for you to some degree once you've established the basket, right? So if you're going to run a model that is going to fire buy and sell signals on the S&P 500, then the first step would be your basket of investment opportunities should probably be pretty highly correlated to the S&P 500, right? On an individual basis, right? Because if the S&P 500 is the quote unquote market and we're saying, okay, we want to be in the market and then determining where we want to be. If we're deciding to be in the market because we think the market is going to be bullish, the S&P 500 is going to be bullish, you probably don't want to buy something that's inversely correlated to the S&P 500 in your basket. So you want to probably build a basket that has funds or stocks or whatever you're looking at that's highly correlated to what your kind of trigger system is. And then from there, momentum kind of takes care of it, right? I would argue that small caps are positively correlated to the S&P 500. However, since they have not had momentum, they're never strong enough relative to their peers to get into the portfolio, in which case you're constantly just rotating into the investment opportunities that are number one correlated to the broader market, in this case, the S&P 500, and that are performing best. So momentum does take care of that for you, and not, you don't have to make a call like, I think this is a cycle for small caps, right? If it's a cycle for small caps, then small caps will bubble up to the top, right, of the investment universe, and then the momentum strategy will buy them.
But that's going to also be a function of the look back period, right? Meaning, you know, if you have a longer look back period, then, you know, you need more evidence of that relative strength picking up to be sustainable. Whereas if you're, you know, shorter look back period, there's more whipsaw risk, which means, of course, you could get, you know, ground to death, or you might get it just in time for the compounding. So I think there's a little bit of a nuance also just in terms of your time frame, even when thinking in those terms.
There definitely is, but there always is. I think that comes down to, you know, how are you as an investor, if you're doing this individually? Do you want to be a short-term trader, right? I teach the class, like I said, and, you know, they're college seniors, and some of them want to be short-term day trader type people. So I tell them, like, look, okay, you should probably be looking at 5-minute charts, 1-day charts. Others don't really care. They just want to have an idea of how the market works because they're going to graduate at the end of the semester and they know they're going to be putting money in their 401k. Okay, cool. You look at weekly and monthly charts. Time frame is always personal for individual investors. As a professional money manager, your time frame kind of comes down to your mandate. But I think, yes, your point is 100% correct. You have to take time frame into consideration, or like anything else, just like we were discussing earlier with the indicators, there's no rule out there that says you have to use just one time frame. You can blend time frames, which is what we do, to get a blended momentum score to kind of incorporate some of the shorter term momentum that creeps into the market while still kind of honoring the bigger picture, longer term trends that are out there.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion. So I'm going to ask a question which I think is important, but I'm sure some people not in the industry might have in the back of their minds, which is that word mandate. Why even have a mandate? Meaning, why not just be go anywhere, invest any which way, you know, from a discretionary perspective?
I mean, you can do that, right? I mean, I guess it's a function of the funds that you launch and the type of investor that you choose to be. as a professional, you know, but most people gravitate towards a certain investment style, whether through, you know, training or experiences throughout their career, right? Some people gravitate towards being, you know, growth investors and, you know, people like Ron Barron of Barron Funds here in New York City, or, you know, the growth teams at AllianceBernstein are their heroes and they want to own growth stocks and move with the market. And then there are some people who, you know, are disciples of Warren Buffett and gravitate towards being value managers. But the funds themselves, you know, they're a product that is, that are, you know, being sold to investors, and those products have a mandate, right? For us, we are tactical managers. I think you and I are probably in the same Morningstar bucket, if I'm not mistaken, as tactical managers. Now, why does that make sense to me? Because I believe in tactical management. I believe that timing the market when done properly adds value, largely by sidestepping drawdowns, right? So why have a mandate? Listen, I think, would it be great to be able to go anywhere, do anything? Sure. You know, that's just not how I choose to invest. And it's not even, you know, I shouldn't say that's not how I choose to invest. I mean, the funds were in place here when I joined. So we're tactical managers, largely as a result of our systematic strategy and the beliefs of the folks who run the firm.
It also doesn't mean you can necessarily stand on and compete on from an industry perspective. It is, I think it's hard for a lot of people that are not in the industry to understand. If you're going to try to raise assets, you have to create a strategy, which is also different, right?
Yeah, so that's interesting too. And it's a double-edged sword. I think being different is a double-edged sword, because everybody says they want something that's different until they get a different result, right?
Right, exactly right. Yeah.
More likely to be seen in a market, a runaway bull market, where a tactical strategy might lag because it chooses to look different, right? I always say that choosing to look different is opening yourself up to questions. It's also opening yourself up to career risk, which is fine. But, you know, to your point, what we try to do as much as possible is not put ourselves in a situation where we get the risk off signal right and still lose money. So we can and will go to cash in our portfolios across the board. We can go 100% to cash and ride out risk-off situations as we define them by our composite model. Now, one of the first projects that I worked on when I arrived here 3 years ago was seeing if there was a way to improve upon that, i.e., when our model fires risk-off, are there positions that we could take that would still add value? And what's interesting is we agree with a lot of your work that historically treasuries as a risk-off asset can add value. Digging deeper into them, there was some, what we found was some nuance into that. Largely speaking, it became a function of trend. So rotating into treasuries as a risk-off asset, as long as the trend was up, broadly speaking, it was more nuanced than that, but it tends to be good. But if the trend is down, they tend not to help you. I think 2022 ended up being a great example of that. So we kind of just came to the conclusion that we want to minimize these situations where we get the risk off call right and still lose money.
Which is worth, yeah, as you and I both know, is easier said than done. And
it's much easier said than done, because you're probably, yeah, you're not always going to time it completely
right,
perfectly,
exactly.
Right? And we're not trying to. I think one of the other things that we run across is people who have a technical angle to the market, or people who are systematic, is everyone wants to know where's the top, where's the bottom, right? And for the most part, we are not trend following in the CTA sense of trend following, but trend following is a large component of what we do. So the majority of the time, we're probably going to miss the turns, quite honestly. And that's okay. We're okay with that, because the way we structure the portfolios allows us to either catch up or sidestep a large part of a drawdown if it does turn into something bigger. So we're not consciously trying to sell the top and buy the bottom.
Yeah, and there's also this added nuance, which is just, yeah, at least in the world that I live in, from the mutual fund ETF side, you know, there's so many ETFs, so many mutual funds out there. That point about differentiating yourself, you know, it's like, how else can a fund compete against Vanguard? Again, I go back to, you have to do something different, which, to your point, then brings up questions when you have these times when you're really dislocated relative to the cycle and the process you have, but you know, there are elements to the industry which are myths by those that don't understand how somebody could be in quotes a professional money manager but not be participating, because participation alone doesn't get you assets. Diverging when things are going to hell, you know, which is the real risk off, is what gets you assets, right? That's the sort of more industry mindset.
Well, we have, I mean, our one-liner to that is, if you want the S&P, just buy the S&P, right? You could buy the S&P 500 for 3 basis points, right? And, you know, there are, I mean, everybody thinks of the S&P 500 ETF as SPY, but, you know, there are actually 2 ETFs out there that are cheaper than SPY from an expense standpoint. So, if you want the S&P, buy the S&P. And if you want something different, make sure you really understand what different is and understand if that's what you really want in your portfolio. And we do a good job, in my opinion, of educating our client base. Now, our client base is predominantly financial advisors who tap our strategies through various platforms. And we do what I think is a really good job of educating them about what we do, how we do it, why we do it. So the folks that invest with us generally have a pretty good understanding of what that ride could be like. And I think that's important as a money manager, is to really kind of level set expectations, because right? But until you actually live the life cycle of that fund and understand what the ride is like, you're not really going to have a full understanding. So I think it's important as money managers as well to do a good job of educating your clients about what you do and why you do it.
Just reset the room for me, 20, 25 minutes. Everybody, please make sure you follow Dan Russo here on X. If any of you want to come up and ask questions, click that bottom left mic request button. And as always, this will be in a podcast under Lead Lag Live on all your favorite platforms. Okay, you mentioned some of the nuances on treasuries as the risk-off play. The nuance I keep going back to from my own research is that treasuries are not a hedge to the stock market. Treasuries are a hedge to credit spreads, which means they're a hedge to vol spiking, VIX spiking, because there's a direct link between the VIX and credit spreads. And that's what makes it look like a hedge to stocks, right? You need to have the spread widening to full risk to spark the flight to safety. What I put on X is the Phoenix, you know, Giphy, which I keep being wrong on timing, which I hope I'm going to be right on at some point. But let's bring the discussion to where we are now in terms of the market environment. I keep going back to, I find it incredible how many divergences I myself am seeing. Now, maybe it's looking at faces in the cloud, but the bond market seems to not be worried about credit, with credit spreads where they are. Meanwhile, default bankruptcies are rising, suggesting that the default premium or discount rather is underappreciated. It's not, it should be higher. And I see things that say that small caps are worried about credit risk because there's no other explanation for why the Russell 2000 has gone largely sideways while, you know, cash flowed small cap companies are doing quite well. How do you think about the bond market here, the duration side and the credit side? Because I think people are confusing the two.
People generally confuse the two. The bond market is kind of a big behemoth that's not super easy to understand. And I think there are a lot of people out there who probably do a better job than I do of breaking it down. So I'm just going to kind of come at it from the perspective of how I view the world, which is from, you know, a trend and momentum perspective. And I think you're right. The bond market at this point doesn't seem to be sniffing out anything major, whether you're looking at high yield OAS spreads, whether you're looking at triple C OAS spreads, or just looking at junk bonds in general, right? I mean, you have an environment where funds like JNK and HYG are holding up well, while investment grade credit via a fund like LQD has started to roll over, and treasuries have been heading lower throughout most of the year. So I think that the message of the bond market is very kind of muddied and convoluted at this point, which again kind of gets to the point of you can't just have one data point and one way of looking at the world. It has to be that mosaic. But, you know, for the most part, you know, what we're seeing is treasury yields are drifting higher while junk holds up. So, I mean, if you believe the bond market is smart money, the smart money is kind of telling you that there's nothing to worry about. Now, that doesn't mean a situation can't crop up pretty quickly. What I've noticed about spreads is that the OAS spreads do a slightly better job than the VIX of getting in front of potential volatility situations. I mean, like the VIX tends to be really coincident, whereas high yield OAS spreads tend to give you a little bit of a heads up. And that's not the case right now. So high yield OAS spreads are still heading lower. The VIX, as we know, has just kind of been grinding out in the mid to low teens. I think what you said about treasuries being a hedge, not a hedge so much against equities, but a hedge against credit risk is interesting. And I think we're going to get a chance to see that thesis play out or not play out potentially, because one of the big themes that we've been talking about for, I guess, coming up on 2 years now is the correlation between stocks and bonds. And the correlation between stocks and bonds has turned positive over both the 1 year and 5 year look back periods, notwithstanding the first quarter of this year where treasuries have drifted lower and stocks have drifted higher. And I think that's interesting because you and I are about the same age, probably started our careers about the same time. For the entirety of our careers up until 2022, stocks and bonds were mostly inversely correlated, right? And that created an environment where a 60-40, 70-30 portfolio does really well for the average investor. But what's interesting is that is not the norm, right? What played out for, I call it 24 years, I mark long-term capital as the start of the change in correlations, and we can just mark 2022 as the end for now. So for 24 years, the inverse correlation between stocks and bonds is not the norm. And generally speaking, stocks and bonds tend to move together. And the driver of that is inflation. And we were predominantly in a disinflationary environment. Again, 1998, the collapse of long-term capital and kind of the start of the bailout era, if you will, is where I market and where you had these disinflationary events, right? We all know what happened to inflation. We all know what happened to interest rates. And now we've shifted to a more inflationary type environment. And I'm not saying inflationary means CPI has to be running 9%, but the simple fact of the matter is for the past 15 years, CPI has been running between 0 and 2%. And now even if you settle out in the 3-4 range, I would argue that's an inflationary type environment, which shifts the correlation between stocks and bonds. So you could be in a situation where under normal circumstances, as stocks drift lower, so do bonds. And then they don't really provide the protection that you're looking for until you have some sort of event, which is your view, which I think gets confused by a lot of people.
Yes, that is exactly what. Yeah, because I can go back, and a credit event is just another way of saying a VIX spike. I mean, it's the same dynamic. And you're right, credit spreads tend to move slightly ahead of the VIX, not by a huge amount as a lead.
No, you're not going to get a 6 month lead.
Right, exactly.
So, like, you do get more of a lead, at least from what I've seen, relative to the VIX, which is really coincident. If the VIX is spiking, the market's already heading lower. Whereas if you look at something like the high yield OAS, that started to drift up ahead of, say, 2020. And it certainly started to drift up ahead of, you know, I think, you know, 2018 was kind of the start, in my opinion, was the start of a bear market. If you looked at anything other than the S&P and the NASDAQ 100, you know, 2018 to 2020, it was a bear market. And high yield spreads started drifting up ahead of that.
A question from the audience saying, what if risk off provides a false signal and the market runs away? Do you move from 100% cash to positions immediately? Or on average, what's the churn in the last several years? Now, I think this is actually a good question. It's also why I'm very much against shorting, right? Because it's in the false signals where you lose money with shorting. But at least if you're long what I call imperfect hedges, like gold, the dollar, utilities, treasuries, you can be wrong, the market can run away, but you can still have a chance at compounding because it's not a pure directional bet on equities. But in terms of what you guys do, when it seems increasingly clear you're in a false signal, what do you do?
We wait for the model.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
And, you know, the key to the model is there's not just one input. Again, it's the thoughtful combination of indicators. So again, we're confident that if it is a confirmed uptrend and the market is going to continue to drift higher, we are confident that the way we structure our portfolios will help us catch up over time. Does that mean we're immediately going to get caught up to the market? Absolutely not. There could be a period of time where we'd lag. But if we think about things over the course of a cycle, we're confident that the way we position the portfolios is what's going to help us catch up, which is why, again, we're not trying to catch the bottom, right? We're not trying to catch October. We're trying to see a confirmed uptrend, get that confirmation from our indicators, right? Our indicators, broadly speaking, are trying to identify what is the trend, okay, the market going up or down or sideways. How healthy is the trend? We do that through various breadth indicators. If the market's going up and it's strong, you'd expect to see strong breadth, more stocks going up than going down, more volume in the stocks that are going up than it's going down. And then we use intermarket analysis, which I know you know well. I have read your father's book, and we incorporate intermarket themes into our work, right? So that level of confirmation. But it's really, over time, my view is the way to outperform over time is not even so much being right on the upside. It's being less wrong on the downside, right? Because it's just simple math, right? If the S&P 500 or your benchmark or your account, whatever it is, gets cut in half, you need 100% to get back to even, right? If you, instead of getting cut in half, only lose 25%, well, then you only need 33% to get back to even. Now, only 33 sounds ridiculous. It's still a big number, but it's not 100%. Right. So long-term outperformance of strategies, in my opinion, doesn't so much come from catching up on the way up. While that is important, it's the not being down as much in the catastrophic drawdowns, right? Not wearing the entirety of catastrophic drawdowns is, in my opinion, the key to long-term success in the market.
And it's also just outright fact. So
you can't dispute it.
Right. But even like if you do, you know, comparative analysis of any strategy and you look at up capture versus down capture metrics, how much do you capture against the S&P, let's say, as your benchmark versus the down capture percentage? It's okay if your up capture is not 100%. Let's say your up capture, you're only getting 90% of the upside, 80% of the upside. Well, that's fine because if you're capturing only 70, 60, 50% of the downside, you're generating meaningful alpha, right? And you are outperforming because of the down capture being less than the up capture. Your up capture is going to be less than 100% because of false signals. Your down capture will be less than the up capture because at some point you get the true signal and the magnitude of the decline and hopefully the mitigation of it is what causes you to really do well. But that even goes back to a discussion around cycles, because if we agree that's facts, right, that you generate outperformance from the downside, not the upside, and that's why it's so hard for most people to beat the market, in quotes, unless they take leverage or excess risk. Well, then you still need to be in a cycle where there's downside to capture. You still need to be in an environment where you're going to get those occasional drawdowns in equities to show the value of avoiding them. And that can still take a while, right? As we've seen the last 2 years.
Yeah, which again gets back to your point of why shorting the quote unquote market is so hard. Like systematic, listen, I spend a percentage of my time trying to look for ways to systematically short the market and add value. It's extremely difficult to find something where find a strategy where you can systematically short the market and actually make money. Because why? The market drifts up over time, right? To actually be a perma bear is to argue with probability. Because over rolling 12 month periods, the market's up 70, 75% of the time. You have to be nuts to be permanently bearish. That being said, my default setting is actually bearish. I turn bearish in a heartbeat if you ask me my views, which is why I have to be a systematic investor, which is why I cannot view the market any other way. Because on any given day, if you ask me my view of the market, after I say I don't know, I'm probably going to try to pitch you the bear case. That's just how I'm wired. I think it's a function of when I started at the top of the dot-com bubble and kind of having a front row seat for some major disasters in the financial markets over time. But being systematic is important. Because I would literally be one of those people with just cash in the mattress and getting crushed by inflation if I wasn't a systematic investor. That being said, systematically shorting the market is ridiculously hard to do, right? The people who do well on the short side tend to be stock specific. They tend to be catalyst driven, i.e. they have a call on an event and they get that event right to the downside. It is very difficult to do well and very difficult to do systematically.
Let's shift gears a little bit to where there's some resurgence of momentum, maybe even the start of a resumption of an uptrend. You mentioned you want to touch on commodities. I actually have been writing about it a little bit more recently. It is interesting. It's not just oil. A lot of commodities are showing some renewed signs of strength. Maybe it's, you know, noise. Maybe it's signal. Copper had a pretty sizable week last week from what I saw, but what's your take on commodities here? I mean, I'm going to assume it's all consistent with this kind of second wave of inflation narrative that's starting to get out there?
I think that, you know, I think that if you're trying, I think the narrative that inflation has been beat can probably be put through some questioning based on what we're seeing in the market, right? Whether you, so I write a weekly note for our clients, people who are invested in our funds. And, you know, I wrote today about things like gold breaking out and heading higher, coin breaking out and heading higher. If you just look at a ratio of tips to aggregate bonds, right, you can do this pretty easily, TIPS relative to AGG, you'll see a nice steady uptrend that pulled back to a key moving average and is now moving higher. So I think while we are not in the narrative business, I think that if you are in the narrative business and you are being pitched, we've whipped inflation, you probably need to question that narrative because the market is questioning that narrative, whether it's, you know, through a drift higher in interest rates, whether it's through an uptick in some of the key commodities. You mentioned copper, you're seeing gold, oil has started to turn higher off of a low. And again, I always just kind of get a kick out of people who, you know, knock gold and they say, well, gold went nowhere for the past 2 years while inflation spiked to 9%. Yeah, but what did gold do for the year and a half leading up to that? It rallied hard. So did Bitcoin, right? If you believe that markets are discounting mechanisms, then you have to believe that things like gold and things like Bitcoin are going to rally ahead of an uptick in the CPI, which is what you saw, right? Bitcoin bottomed in, I believe it was March or April of 2020, and then started to rip higher ahead of the turn higher in CPI. Gold bottomed, I believe it was somewhere in 2019, and then started to turn higher ahead of the CPI. So you're seeing, I guess, what would be considered leading indicators of inflation starting to move higher once again, right? Bitcoin recently took out its prior high. Gold just broke out, took out its prior high. Some of the other industrial type commodities are heading higher. And then just look from a sector standpoint, right? You don't even have to look, you don't even have to be super deep in the weeds the way we are on markets. Just take the 11 S&P 500 sectors and look at who's leading and who's lagging to plug your note over different look back periods. And over the past 12 months, it's what you'd expect. It's tech, it's discretionary, it's comm services. However, over the past month, what is it? Energy, materials, utilities, and staples. That's interesting, right? That's telling you that, well, I guess energy and materials are kind of that inflationary impulse. And utilities and staples might be saying a little bit of defensiveness. And those were the top groups last month, last week as well, or at least two of them were. So that's kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, and it could be ominous. I mean, we'll see. That could be a false signal.
Could be a false signal. Yeah, those could be false signals as well. But I mean, again, you know, you're starting to see it. So I think that at the very least, if you want to be intellectually honest and you're being pitched a narrative that we've beaten inflation and inflation is going to go right back down to 2%, I think that if you're paying attention to the market, you should at least question that and ask yourself, is this true? Does the market agree with this? Because right now, it seems to me that the market does not.
Dan, for those who want to track more of your thoughts, more of your work, or might be interested in learning about some of the strategies you guys run, where'd you point them to?
You could check out our website, PotomacFund.com. I'm on Twitter, at @DanRusso_CMT. We're actually pretty active on LinkedIn as well, under our own names. We're easy to find. We're not hiding anywhere. We're not trying to be a black box. You know, if you're interested in more information about what we do, I would start with our website and that will take you through it.
Everybody, please make sure you give Dan a follow. Great conversation. I'll have this as a podcast in a couple of days here, and hopefully I'll see you all tomorrow on another space. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate you, man.
Thanks, everyone. I appreciate it.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction.
Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.